Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Close Up Talk Radio, the unique internet broadcast series that brings you together with some of the most amazing, important, and interesting individuals from the worlds of business, industry, travel, health and wellness, art, entertainment, and more. From company owners, CEOs, and presidents, to the technical wizards behind the scenes who create the magic that make their company's products and services so special. Here's your opportunity to hear firsthand the fascinating stories of how it all happened from those who actually made it possible. Now, live, this is Close Up Talk Radio.
Thank you so much for joining us. We are live worldwide on CUTV News Radio. I'm your host, Jim Masters. We appreciate your taking time out of your busy schedule to join us today, and we do appreciate all the response we get from our faithful listeners around the world who tell us that they are engaged with and learn so much from our guest experts that we feature here exclusively on CUTV News Radio. And we're very excited on our broadcast to welcome somebody who's joining us for the very first time, Renaud Kennedy, clinical and forensic psychology expert. And we're going to talk about the incredible work that she does. But first, you know, sometimes even judges don't have all the information they need to make rulings. And in these instances, our justice system relies upon expert witnesses whose testimony assists in rendering decisions on questions before the court. Forensic psychology is sort of a marriage between psychology and the law. Dr. Renaud Kennedy is a clinical and forensic psychologist who specializes in providing expert witness testimony for both criminal trials and civil litigation. Says behind every one of these incidents is a very important story, and she listens to every person's story. Her job is to learn about an individual worldwide to see where it clashes with legal questions and help courts make determinations that are fair and equitable. Forensic psychologists are most commonly used to determine an individual's sanity at the time of a crime. And once a determination has been made about how an individual goes into the system, the question remains, how long can they be kept within those confines of the system before they can be released? Psychologists like Dr. Kennedy study these individuals to understand the concept of dangerousness, the risk factors associated with recidivism, and so much more. It is amazing work. It is detailed work. It's fascinating work, and it is incredible work. And we're going to hear a little bit about how this work actually comes to be and the way that Dr. Kennedy does this so beautifully. First, let's welcome Dr. Renaud Kennedy to our show for the very first time. Dr. Kennedy, we realize you're in beautiful Honolulu, Hawaii. It's a little early, so we do thank you for taking time out of your very, very busy schedule to join us here live on CUTV News Radio. Welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for asking me to participate.
You are very, very welcome, and thank you for joining us. In your own life's journey, in your own travels, were you always inspired by and always drawn to this type of work, Doctor?
No, it was an evolution of my life from many iterations of experiences with others. So it was not something where I was directionally focused from the time that I was beginning college.
Now, the work of a forensic psychologist, people might not be too clear on what the work is. I just outlined a little bit of it, and that just scratches the surface at the beginning of the show. Can you tell us a little bit more about the work that you do and the role of a forensic psychologist?
Sure, I'll be happy to. Let's first talk about the role of the forensic psychologist, and then I will talk about the work that I do. essentially, a forensic psychologist is a person who has expertise in psychology. So that is the baseline that a person has, and that's how human beings function, normally and abnormally. The forensic component of that is the overlay of questions of law as it applies to a human individual in a context in which they're in some sort of legal litigation, whether that's a criminal case, whether that's a civil matter, whether it's a family court case. So the work I do is essentially to assist the court in their fact-finding, and as they make a determination about that individual, when they are concerned about components of their personality and how that interacts with the question that's before them, whether that's a criminal event like a murder, or whether that's relating to personal injury and a person is in a tort claim, or whether it's a family law matter where we're looking at custody types of relationships when best interests of children are at the forefront.
Now, in what context do you find yourself using forensic psychology? Again, during the introduction, I touched upon it a little bit, but can you detail a little bit more some of these scenarios where forensic psychology would be coming into play?
Sure. When the court has a question, the court doesn't have all the answers, as you mentioned at the top of the show. And so the court cannot leave the courtroom. The court has to appoint individuals to go out of the courtroom to investigate and to bring back information that will help them in their decision making. So essentially what I become is a fact finder for the court on a particular question that they instruct me to answer. So in my work, most of everything that I do is court appointed, which essentially means that the judge will ask me to answer a question that they are concerned about in their course of the case. Now, sometimes I'm court appointed and paid for by the state or the federal government. Other times in court appointments, I am paid for mutually by both parties and sometimes by one party, depending on the nature of the case. Either way, regardless of where my pay comes from, my job is to be as neutral, as scientific, and as professional as possible to give a balanced perspective from the science of what we know about a particular individual in that question to the court. And I usually do that either in a written report and or in expert witness testimony where I sit before the court and I'm asked questions by both sides, both counsel, both the prosecution and defense or the plaintiff and defense about particular matters that I have done the investigation on.
So would you say, and is it an accurate assumption that most people are familiar with forensic psychology being used to determine if a person is sane or insane? Is that the general knowledge that people have, or maybe the basic idea of what people have on forensic psychology?
I think classically that's what where our expertise was first used in court, and I would think that that would be, many people think we do, which is one component of a whole array of things that we do, but yes.
So who would be somebody that would hire you to do the work that you do, doctor? Does it run across the board? Are there specific types of scenarios where you'd be brought in and hired to perform the work you perform?
Yes. Let's first talk about criminal cases. So when I am asked to work in a criminal matter, I may be asked by the court or by one or the other parties to assess a person's competence to waive their Miranda rights. I'm also asked, is this person competent to stand trial for what they are accused of? And what that essentially means when we are thinking about competence is, does this a person have the ability to sit in court, to listen, to process, to understand what's going on? Can they work with their attorney in such a way that they understand all of the options that are available to them? And can they assist counsel in listening to other testimony to assist them to figure out what is accurate, what is not accurate? And can they make determinations in such a way that will assist them in their own defense? Because under the Constitution of the United States, we believe that people do have a right to trial, and they do need to understand what the procedures are that they're going through. So my work assists the court in the front end to be able to help somebody determine competency. And then once a person has been found competent, in many cases, then we are asked that question that you mentioned before: was that person criminally responsible at the time of the event that it occurred? And if not, do they meet criteria for what we would call the insanity defense or a diminished capacity?
So what would be some more examples of legal cases that you consult and testify in, Doctor?
Well, in addition to the criminal matters that we just talked about, I'm also asked from time to time to do a determination, as it is an aid in sentencing, to make a decision about risk. So from time to time, after a person has either been placed in a facility who has been mentally ill, then the determination that I write for the court is that person ready for release back into the community? And if so, under what protections should be made for the public as well as for this individual so that they can integrate back into the community? And that is a risk assessment type of a measure, where we're looking at the benefits of keeping somebody within a system versus being able to have them discharged in the community.
Obviously, you know, you're an expert in the law and psychology. They go hand in hand, don't they, with this type of intense work that you do?
Yes. For someone like myself, we need additional training to just the basics of, and I shouldn't say just the basics because it takes many years to get a doctorate in clinical psychology, but you also have to have some specialty, which is understanding many different components of the law in which you can practice as a psychologist with regard to previous cases that have been studied that in case law that apply to the particular issue that you have before you. So you need to have both knowledge in law and particularly mental health law as it applies to the questions of clinical psychology that you're working in.
So is it a learn-as-you-go process? Or do you have to be literally up on everything and all the latest and be extremely updated, you know, by the minute almost? Or, again, is it a learning process as you go?
Every case is different because every human being's situation is different. And so for me, every time I take on a case, I have to learn as much as I can about that person's life and their story and what brought them to the context of the legal question that's there. So every case is a new experience.
Now, what type of education and training does a person need to acquire, Doctor, to become an expert in this particular field of psychology?
Well, the first thing that people need to do is to obviously get their requisite graduate training in psychology, And that essentially means going to a doctoral program and learning about human behavior, its development and abnormal behavior, and how it manifests itself in life, so you'll be able to identify it and know what treatments are necessary. Then on top of that, once you have this classwork kind of experience, then you go into the field and do specialized training with others who are experts in the area. So it's hands-on training with mentors, doing internships, practicums, postdoctoral fellowships, so that you learn case by case from those people who mentor you through this to be able to say that you are qualified and then certified to do the work that you're doing. So it takes many years to do it, but it's also necessary because it's expert and it's specialized in the work that we do.
Absolutely, and very, very complex. And you touched upon it briefly for us, but can you elaborate maybe a little bit more on your path, the path that you followed to become a forensic psychologist?
Well, my path was an intriguing one. I was in Boston and thinking that I had a husband at the time who was doing his doctorate at MIT, and I was working full-time and going to school, and I needed to do a placement, and I wanted to do my placement in the counseling center at MIT. And a wonderful woman who was the vice president for women's affairs met with me, because at the time I was working in the development office, and I asked her if I couldn't shift positions and move into the counseling center, which I had done previously in another school. And she said to me that, yes, we could certainly move you from development over into the counseling center, but she said, let me ask you this question. Where would you like to be in 10 years in your life? Which I appreciated, and I told her that probably working in a college counseling center and maybe being the head administrator of one. And so she said to me, that's wonderful, and I'm certain you would do a good job at it, but let me ask you this question. What kind of experience do you have, Renaud, with severe psychopathology and violence? And I said to her, very little, because most of my work up until that point had been in schools and colleges. And she said, well, my husband runs a program down at through Harvard Medical School at the State Hospital for the Criminally Insane. And this is also a placement that trains people who are Secret Service members to be able to assess risk. And they provide a fellowship, and I think you would be very good at it. And might I ask my husband to call you and take you down to Bridgewater State Hospital for a day to see if you might be willing to do that for just 1 year in your life so that you have this additional experience. So if you go back into a college counseling center, then you will have this severe psychopathology and violence underneath your belt, so that you'll be able to assist. So that was the fork in the road. I decided to go down there as a result of her encouragement, fully thinking that I would go down there and have a day, and then I would come back and say, I still want to work in a counseling center. But it opened up a whole new world for me to see the incredible professionalism of the people that are working there with cases that are very important. And I thought to myself, here is an opportunity in my life that I shouldn't miss. So that embarked me in a very different course in my life from having been a high school teacher and a college counselor into a whole new field. And that's where I progressed from 1985 to where we are today.
Quite a journey. What an amazing journey it is, too.
Yeah.
And yeah, yeah, really. And I'm also fascinated in your constitution. When you hear stories or you're face-to-face with someone who has committed horrible crimes, the average person might be shocked, mortified, overwhelmed by it all. But you stay in that room with them. And what is it about you specifically, would you say? And I know it's not always easy to talk about oneself, but still, obviously there is something within that allows you to, you know, well, it's about you that makes you unique in the sense that you can engage these individuals and be interested in them and curious about them at the same time not being afraid of them as well. What do you think it is, Doctor, about you that allows you to be able to do that and do it so efficiently and so effectively?
Well, I think that's an important question. What's most important is that we are all human beings and we all make decisions. And some of those decisions are good at times and some of them are less wise. But every person has a story and every person has purpose in their behavior. And so for me, as a trained professional, a trained clinician, it is my job to listen to this individual with as much neutrality and absence of bias as possible to understand their perspective and to understand how they got to where they are at a point in time with the legal problem before them and their perspective of how this came about. So it's important to listen. And just like you working with me, it's important to listen well and then to follow that train or that path of thought as it relates to the questions that are necessary to ask someone. So it's important to suspend judgment and your own biases to be able to do the job that you're asked to do. And that takes years of training and good supervision, because it's hard to sit with somebody who has murdered someone. It's difficult to work with somebody who is a child pornography offender. It is difficult to work with someone who has killed a child. But nevertheless, because we have the Constitution of the United States and we need to be able to understand these human beings who have brought themselves to this place, we need all the assistance that's necessary to make decisions about them. And so that's been my life task.
Incredible. How, I guess the audience would be thinking, because I know definitely as host, I'm thinking, how do you absorb it? I've often even in different scenarios have asked those a similar question who are in the medical field when they see the things that they see in an operating room, in an emergency room, the doctors, the nurses, the EMTs. Day in and day out, they see some of life's tragedies. They see the fragility of life. They see how anything can happen at any time and how lives are affected. Some of them say they sort of shut it out or they don't become numb to it. There is an effect, but they're able to control it and they realize there's a job that needs to be done and they need to just go in and do the things that need to be done to save a life or to make somebody well. With the work that you do in a similar fashion in a way, how do you absorb it? How do you not let it take control? You must be a really strong person, like a doctor, like a nurse, like an EMT.
Well, or like a judge. What I would say
same
that
thing.
We have to do is we have to listen, and we have to listen well to what this person's perspective is, and we have to apply it to the question at hand. So in some ways, it's an academic experience, which is really thinking cognitively and putting that cognitive part of your brain to work and not having yourself be overwhelmed by the emotional aspect of whatever it is that is in front of you. Because if you become flooded emotionally, then you're not effective to anyone. And that's essentially what your professional training teaches you to do, is how to stay objective, how to stay professional, how to stay on task, but yet at the same time, understanding that the person that's on the other side of you that you're speaking to is in substantial distress and is in a significant point in their life, which is a crisis, and that it's necessary for you to be there with them and to get the information and to extrapolate it in such a way that it can be used by the authorities in a way that's meaningful to them.
You know, we've been focused on violence, but you also work with, of course, family law and civil litigations too, and we'll get into a lot of that next week as well. We've got another whole full half hour with you next week, so we'll delve in a lot about family court and things of that nature. But I also see that you've worked as a consultant for state agencies on issues for mental health as well. If we can, let's talk a little bit about that type of work.
Sure, I'd be happy to. It's sometimes systems need interventions just like people do. And so I have worked as a contract consultant for a number of different state and private agencies about issues of mental health. So to give you an example, many years ago, and it seems to be more the norm now than it used to be, but we experienced for the first time ever children who were under the age of majority who were killing one another. And they were doing it in violent ways. And the courts were left with, what do we do with these children? So one of my first jobs in Massachusetts and then later in the state of Kentucky was to create a adolescent confinement facility for those children awaiting trial for the crimes that they had done, and to help assist those people that were evaluating them make determinations as to whether they could be rehabilitated, because at the age of their maturity, they are released back into the community. So can an 11-year-old who has killed someone be properly rehabilitated to the age in which they are able to be released? And that depends from state to state when that can occur. And can they be ready so that they don't go out and damage the world again? And what is it in our confinement of that individual that we can provide them to try to put the pieces together so that they can be a functioning human being? So that was some of the contract work I did early on, and I really enjoyed doing that work because I found it very important to think about all of the things that make up a human being to make them healthy, and how can you supplant that when you have somebody who has killed an individual. So that was some of the work that I have done. I've also been the director in Hawaii of the Adult Mental Health Division's Forensic Services, which oversees the execution of the sanity panel examinations, meaning all of those people that do them, supervising that process and making sure that it goes smoothly. And I've also been the first mental health director for the prison system in the state of Hawaii, making sure that we execute the services under the Department of Justice's stipulations under the CRIPA laws, which is the constitutional rights of institutionalized persons who are mentally ill, making sure that we provide the services that are necessary while they are in the confines of prison.
Yeah.
So I've applied my mental health services to many different areas.
Incredible work that you do, Doctor. I do want to let the audience know once again that you'll be back with us next week at 11 a.m. Eastern, and we look forward to that. And I want to thank you so much for joining us on the show today. The work that you do is incredible, and we appreciate your joining us on the broadcast today. You'll be back Tuesday, January 31st at 11 a.m. Eastern here on CUTV News Radio. Thanks so much for joining us, Doctor.
And thank you.
Have a wonderful day. And thank you for joining us as well, everybody. I am your host, Jim Masters. This is CU TV News Radio. We hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Dr. Mo Kennedy will be back with us same time next week here on CU TV News Radio. Have a great day.